Welcome everyone. I was worried this afternoon that it would be still raining and that we would only have a few people here, so I'm tickled that we have as many here as we have tonight due to the inclement weather. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We're a non-for-profit organization, and our focus is to bring philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. Do we have any first-time visitors at all? Okay, yes, sir. How did you...
Oh.
Yes.
Well, I can't really call myself a first-time visitor because I used to occasionally go here... when it was over at Golden Corral, so during
okay.
Years ago.
We're upgraded. We've moved up in the world. Great, so did you just type in Dallas Philosophers Forum? You just decided you wanted to get some philosophy tonight, or what?
Yes.
Cool, that's great. You know, I was walking in here, and there was a gentleman with a SMU sweatshirt, and he said, you having your meeting tonight? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you ever go? And he said, no, I'm a stockbroker. I'm not a philosopher. And so I thought, well, you know, philosophy transcends those. I mean, it's broader than just, you know, the impression one has of philosophy in school. So I was like, well, you got to come out sometime and see what we have to offer. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. We have our stand-in treasurer, David Alkeck. He will collect your money for $5. And students with an ID can attend for $2. And if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. We have another new attendee. Okay, sir. How did you find out about us?
Internet.
Okay, internet. Okay, so you just type in philosophy Dallas or what? He's good. Okay, great. Well, welcome. We're really glad that you're here. You're in for a good treat tonight. Also, I want to remind everyone to pay for your meal or your drinks before you leave at the front of the restaurant. Sometimes someone might inadvertently forget, and then we have the Dallas Philosophers Forum has to pay for that meal. So please remember to do that, and be generous with your wait staff. They've been very accommodating here. The restaurant, and I don't think that they give up this room anymore. So we're lucky we got grandfathered in on that point. We have a website that has much of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org. You can sign up for our email list on the website. And then please forward, if you like what you hear, please forward that link on to others and encourage them to come. And you can sign up for updates on meetings at the www.meetup.com/Dallas Philosophers Forum/members. So tonight, our speaker, as we normally do, will speak around 45 to 50 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions. If that horn will stop going off, then it'll help us a little bit. Please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. So we're very privileged to have David Drum with us tonight. David was kind enough to fill in at the last second when our scheduled speaker, Brian Ridd, who was going to speak on the philosophy of research, he had to cancel. He received an honor in Germany, and so he is off to Deutschland. And so I think we're going to get him to speak in the spring, right, David? He'll be speaking in February. February, so we're excited about getting him. He's quite a talented speaker. David Drum is a current board member and treasurer of the Dallas Philosophers Forum, as well as past president. He is a summa cum laude graduate of UT at Austin with a JD cum laude from SMU School of Law. He's been a partner at Carrington, Coleman, Sloman, Blumenthal, LLP since 1987, with practice areas in real property and oil and gas transactions. His keen intellect and talent transcends law. Mr. Drum is a frequent speaker here and at the Unity Church in Dallas on a variety of theological and philosophical subjects, including sex ecology and spirituality, Buddhism, the creative process, and metaphysics, also the joys of sex. So there's a kind of a theme going here. S-E-C-T-S, the joy of sex. Anyway, Mr. Drone will be speaking tonight about the process lawsuit of Alfred North Whitehead. And now please join me in welcoming David Drone.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here and have a chance to share a little bit about one of my favorite philosophers, Alfred North Whitehead, which will be a little bit of a challenge in the time allotted, but I will do my best. Alfred North Whitehead was born in England in 1861, and he matriculated at Trinity College, Cambridge University, and became a professor of mathematics there, had a real talent for mathematics. And Bertrand Russell, who you may have heard of, has written a famous history of Western philosophy, was one of his students at Cambridge. Another one of his students is Willard Quine, who also acquired some notoriety as a philosopher of the 20th century. Alfred North Whitehead and his student Bertrand Russell decided to team up between the period 1910 to 1913 to write a three-volume work with the title Principia Mathematica, which set out to derive all of the truths of mathematics from a few simple axioms and purely by a logical process to basically prove all of the truths. Now, I've never attempted to read this particular work, but I've read that in the three volumes, they get to a proof of the proposition that 1 plus 1 is 2 on page 86 of the second volume, which gives you some example of kind of the rigorous nature of Whitehead's thinking. And he approaches all of his subject matters, including the metaphysics he later got to, I'll get that in a minute, with the same kind of rigor, which I will have to say does not make for the most exciting reading in the world. And so you read Whitehead for the discoveries that come out of the text that you have to torture out of the text, and not because he spoon feeds it to you and makes it easy and it has this gift of explanation. You know, I think he's got a gift of insight and a gift of rigorous method. He does not have a gift of easily explaining things, and so if you decide to pick him up and read him, be forewarned on that. He had several children, and he had a son, Eric, that died in combat in World War I, and was some effect on his life, and he broke ranks with Bertrand Russell, and for that matter with Willard Quine, who kind of stayed in the linguistic analysis sort of side of philosophy, that the role of philosophy is to clarify the language we use to talk about things and to rule certain metaphysical subjects as basically out of bounds because the language is not adequate to discourse of those subjects. And you can take two views of that. Russell considered Whitehead, I think, somewhat soft-headed after his emotional experience with his son and thought he kind of basically went off the rails. I think the other way to look at it is that Whitehead got a little bit of sort of an expanded view and was able to look at things a little bit more broadly. He gravitated from Cambridge to the University of London. And he transformed from being a professor of mathematics to being a professor of science. He was conversant with the new theories of relativity and quantum physics, which were just emerging at the time that he was a professor of science at University of London. And in 1920, he wrote a book called The Concept of Nature that sort of began to develop his mature theories, his mature philosophy. And what that particular book sets out the germ of an idea that was developed later, that scientism, meaning the worldview that the methods of science can explain all of phenomena, according to Whitehead, itself had a hidden metaphysic, and the scientists were fond of saying that they didn't get into metaphysics, they just eschewed metaphysics, that was aside, and Whitehead's view was, no, you've got a metaphysic, you know, and it's that particular metaphysic that is shaping the way you're looking at things, and, you know, maybe there are some alternative metaphysics that can also be rigorously derived that will have broader explanatory powers than the pure method of scientism. I forgot to mention, when he was at Cambridge, he was a member of the prestigious group called the Cambridge Apostles that was founded by Alfred Lord Tennyson in 1809, I believe. It was sort of the intellectual elite of the Cambridge area. And the professors at that time talked and tried to be conversant across disciplines. You know, if you were a mathematics professor, you didn't just deal with mathematics and talk to the people in that department. The mathematicians would talk to the literary scholars, and the literary scholars would talk to the biologists, and so there's a lot of cross-fertilization in his ideas. He also served as president of the Aristotelian Society in London from 1922 to 1923. In 1924, at the age of 63, which is interesting but to me because that's my present age, he was asked to come overseas to take a chair at Harvard University, which he accepted. And that was a chair in philosophy. And so he went from mathematics to science to philosophy in terms of discipline. And in 1925, he wrote probably his most famous and accessible book called Science in a Modern World, where he begins to set out his metaphysic in detail. In 1926, he wrote a book called Religion in the Making, which sets out some of his ideas about religion, which he does treat. In 1929, he wrote what is generally regarded as his magnum opus, which is called Process and Reality. And that's a fairly difficult read compared to Science in the Modern World. And then wrote Adventures of Ideas in 1933, retired from Harvard in 1937 at the age of 77, and wrote his last important book, Modes of Thought, in 1938, and died in 1947. His primary influence is in philosophy, it's kind of interesting, and we have two divergent traditions. We have an Anglo-American tradition of empiricist philosophy, philosophy that's built around observation of facts and inferential reasoning from observation of facts. And then we have a continental tradition, which is more rational and deductive. It's about establishing first principles and reasoning from first principles down. And the interesting thing about Whitehead is he came out of the Anglo-American tradition, and his primary influences, the ones he talks about the most, are Locke and Hume. And he accepts a great deal of Locke and Hume's methodology, but he departs from Locke and Hume at a certain juncture and reaches, you know, an entirely different conclusion than either of those two thinkers do. And so his conclusions in some ways may align more with some of the continental school of philosophers, the rationalist, but his roots and his method are out of the Anglo-American tradition, which makes him a difficult philosopher to classify or to appreciate. In Process and Reality, he calls his worldview the philosophy of organism, but it has come to be called process philosophy, which I think is a more apt term and has kind of taken over. And so if you look at his system as process philosophy, then you have to ask, what is that in contrast to? And as he sets it out, process philosophy is in contrast to a substance philosophy. And most other systems of philosophy, although they differ in other details, have in common the metaphysical acceptance of the fundamental notion of the doctrine of substance. And it would take probably a couple hours to give a full treatment on the doctor and no substance, but let me hit some highlights here. It basically goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle held that the fundamental unit of being is a substance, and that a substance is defined by its qualities. That's how you're able to categorize it and say what it is. And the qualities of a substance are two types. There are essential qualities and there are accidental qualities. And an essential quality is what makes that substance what it is. And so if the substance is a rock, the essential qualities are going to be being hard, being a certain weight. The accidental qualities might be a certain color that it has, or the fact that it's located on a particular table or on somebody's mantelpiece. You know, that doesn't define its nature as a rock, but it defines that rock. And there's this idea that the substances exist of themselves independently, that the substance could exist in a vacuum without any other objects in the universe, that the substance just inheres in itself. And it's really those doctrines that Whitehead questions. And what he does have in common with Hume and Locke is, and for that matter with Descartes, is he takes his starting place of the experience that we have of being in the world, as other philosophers would call it. You know, what is our unit of experience? And the idea of a substance is that behind that experience there is this inhering subject whose essential qualities do not change, and that is more fundamental than the particular occasion of the experience itself. And he challenges that view and says, no, the experience is really, the word he uses is atomic, meaning that it's you know, complete in itself. He refers to atomic drops of experience that we have. And in terms of common sense navigation of the world, he would say the concept of a substance has a lot of utility. You know, it's not that it's a useless, but he refers to it as an abstraction. You know, we abstract to this idea of a continuing substance out of our experience, and that abstraction is useful in terms of simplifying our explanations of the world, but it does make a difference in how you draw out all the inferences of the theory, what you hold as fundamental and what you hold as derived, because if you start with the idea of substance, in Whitehead's view, there's only a few results that you can really go to. You can be a monist, meaning that there's only one substance, which is where Spinoza, for example, went in the history of philosophy. And if you reason that there's only one substance, then how do you explain the multiplicity in the world? You know, how do you explain the fact that it doesn't seem like it's one substance. Monisms can be either material monisms like Spinoza, or they can be idealistic monisms like some of the Eastern religious systems, which would hold that ideas are real, the world is maya or illusion, you know, not really real. But in a monism, you have difficulty explaining how both mental and physical factors could both be significant. Unless you go to take the Cartesian move and you go to dualism. And Descartes talked about a multiplicity of extended substances and a mental world of intention that somehow God held together, but otherwise they were completely, you know, a completely different wavelength, so to speak. And so the reason Whitehead went to the View he went is he found dualism, materialistic monism, and idealistic monism all unsatisfactory. And I guess the fourth alternative would be to go to a materialistic, scientistic view of multiple substances, meaning that sort of the Newtonian view of the universe, that there are these corpuscles of substances that are, you know, crashing into each other and influencing each other, but deterministically without any, you know, kind of, you know, novelty. Novelty is a favorite Whiteheadian word, without any novelty in the equation. So in contrast to that philosophy of substance, Whitehead said, you know, experience is key. Experience is a process. Experience is not a substance, meaning that experience is dynamic. And these things that we call substances, Whitehead called enduring objects, which he defined as a single line of inheritance of a defining characteristic. And so if you look at David Drum, then the phenomenon David Drum would be a single line of inheritance of certain memories, certain personality traits, you know, certain biological constellations and things from occasion to occasion. But to Whitehead, that would not be primary. The primary would be the experience of David in this moment. And then he has ways of explaining why the outcome of that process is to produce the David of the next moment, because that has to do with a self-survival kind of intention that's sort of built into the you know, the progression, but not fundamental in his view. So the process he referred to sometimes as an actual entity. He also referred to it as an actual occasion, which to me is a little bit more meaningful term. And an actual occasion involves what he called, Whitehead coined a lot of words. I think and part of the reason is he didn't want to use all the words from the philosophical tradition with all the baggage that they had from other thinkers. And so that's one of the things that makes him hard to read, is he's saying, well, that word's not very good, so let me do a new one. One of his new words is called concrescence. And you can sort of think, you can sort of picture like concrete drying. You know, it's basically the process by which something fluid, you know, solidifies and takes a form. And that's the way he described this actual occasion, is that there's a concrescence, a synthesis. And what is synthesized? What is brought together? What is brought together is the influence on that occasion of all other occasions that belong in what he called the causal past of that occasion. So, and he was familiar with Einstein's theory of relativity, so he knew better than to say that there's a simultaneous instant, you know, any place in the universe, regardless of position, but he said, you know, wherever you are on that Einsteinian relativity, there are some occasions that are causally relevant to you. There are other occasions, you know, like more than the speed of light away, that are causally irrelevant to you. As an occasion, you are influenced by all of the other occasions in your causal past. And so part of what this occasion synthesizes is that input from everything. And so, you know, in my case, it's, you know, who smiled at me this morning when I walked in the office? What did my mom and dad teach me? You know, what did I study in college? You know, all of those things in my causal past are part of what I synthesize in the occasion of this moment. The way you do that, here's another Whiteheadian term, is called prehension, which is sort of a combination of perception and understanding and really being causally affected by, but anything that would have an influence on the occasion, the process occasion that is me in this moment, I would have a prehension of. And to Whitehead, prehensions could be conscious, they could be unconscious. And so if the floor is holding my feet under me, then I have a prehension of the floor. That's being communicated to me. It may not come to my conscious awareness. I may have a conscious awareness that Rob is looking at me and nodding his head, and then that would be part of my prehension in the moment too. And so as a actual synthetic occasion, I synthesize all those various prehensions, and that results in an output of the process to the world, which is basically the way that I objectify myself to the world in this moment as a result of all those inputs. And so you take all the, and here's another word, here's another term he coined. We're familiar with a subject-object distinction. He preferred to talk about a subject and a superject. And the reason he did that is that nothing is simply an object. Nothing is simply given. But in the process that is myself, the subject is my own mode of synthesis, my own mode of self-determination. The superject is the outcome of that, what I present to the world as a result of that process. So you can sort of think his subject is kind of the agent of the process. Superject is the output of the process, and all these prehensions of things are the input to the process. So as prehensions have a whole range to them, as we talked about, he referred to prehensions with the primary category of feeling. It's kind of odd for somebody who started as a mathematician to talk so much about feeling, but he thought of feeling as a broader category than intellection or thinking. He thought of intellection or thinking as a subcategory of feeling. And so feeling to him was any kind of these prehensions where there is a felt impact, you know, that registers in the occasion. You know, if I'm standing on the floor and it's holding me up, I may be completely oblivious to it. I may not have a feeling of it. It's nevertheless affecting me. You know, I'm prehending it, but I don't have any feeling prehension of it. If I have, but feeling is not yet conscious awareness. I can feel things, like if I feel a crick in the back of my neck or something like that, then I've got a feeling. You know, it may register, but I may not be conscious of it, or I may have certain blood, you know, level condition or something, you know, that's causing me to, you know, have a certain hormone or something like that, and I'm feeling that, but I'm not conscious of it. So there's one more input though into this process that doesn't have to do with other actual occasions. You know, as we said, everything that's in my causal past is an actual occasion that influences me. But are those my only influences according to Whitehead? No. According to Whitehead, there's another category that he referred to as eternal objects. And these bear a similarity, for those of you familiar with other philosophers, into the category of Platonic ideas. And from his starting point as a mathematician, what these meant to him most, you know, most basically were things like the idea of a perfect circle, you know, the idea of the square root of -1, the idea of, you know, a perfect isosceles triangle that you may not be able to actually model in the actual world, but you've nevertheless got a clear idea of it. And in his definition of this occasion, occasions that are sufficiently organized enough to have conscious thought are able to perceive of these of these eternal ideas with eternal objects, which he also referred to as pure potentials. And part of the synthesis of the occasion can be not only registering and synthesizing the influences of the other actual occasions, but the possibility presented by these eternal objects. And in his system, every output of every occasion has to be consistent with the other contemporaneous occasions. He's got occasions in the causal past, contemporaneous occasions, which are things that happen, you know, at the same time, relativity aside. And then future occasions are the things that can be influenced by the superject, by the output of that occasion. And so the possibilities presented by these eternal objects are not unlimited. They have to be capable of being synthesized in a coherent way, in a coherent, consistent way, but nevertheless do present a set of possible futures, if you will, that can be selected by the extent to which a particular eternal object is, accepted into the synthesis that becomes the next moment. And so this is how Whitehead interjects conclusions that might line up with some of the idealistic philosophers in terms of possibility of moral freedom of action, opens the door really to things like meaning, purpose, value, but in a way, in a method entirely different from the way the idealistic philosophers get there, because he doesn't, to him, the occasion is, he uses the word dipolar. It has a mental pole and a physical pole, and you can't separate the two. You know, the physical pole would be open to these contributions from the other actual occasions. The mental pole is receptive to the perception of the possibility presented by these eternal objects, but they're always correlated into the one occasion. And so for Whitehead, the problem that philosophers define as the mind-body problem is really a non-problem, or his answer to that problem is occasions are dipolar. You know, occasions have a mental pole and a physical pole. The more evolved organisms, you know, make more use of their mental pole. Organisms like single-cell amoebas, you know, they may be, 99.999% physical, only a little bit mental. But for him, those two poles are available, potentially in all organisms. Okay, so that opens up the question then, where do these eternal objects come from? And this is where Whitehead introduces his notion of the idea of God. And it's kind of interesting that with so many of these terms, he coins new terms and shies away from the baggage. On this particular one, I don't know entirely the reason why he does not, because his use of the term God would be a substantially different use than what we would normally associate with theism, classical theism. And to give you an example of that, this is the only passage I'm going to read tonight, I'm going to read from page 342 and 343 of Process and Reality. He says, the notion of God as the unmoved mover is derived from Aristotle, at least so far as Western thought is concerned. The notion of God as imminently real is a favorite doctrine of Christian theology. The combination of the two into the doctrine of an aboriginal, eminently real, transcendental creator at whose fiat the world came into being and who imposed and whose imposed will it obeys, is the fallacy which has infused tragedy into the histories of Christianity and of what he calls Mahometism, we now call Islam. When the Western world accepted Christianity, Caesar conquered, and the received text of Western theology was edited by his lawyers. The church gave unto God the attributes which belonged exclusively to Caesar. And then he goes on to say, there is, however, in the Galilean origin of Christianity, yet another suggestion which does not fit very well with any of the three main strands of thought. It does not emphasize the ruling Caesar, or the ruthless moralist, or the unmoved mover. It dwells upon the tender elements in the world which slowly and in quietness operate by love, and it finds purpose in the present immediacy of a kingdom not of this world. Love neither rules nor is it unmoved. Also, it is a little oblivious as to morals. It does not look to the future, for it finds its own reward in the immediate present. So, he goes on to say that he agrees with Hume's, disapproval of the theistic God. Nevertheless, though, he finds the concept useful to explain. In the sense he's talked about, not as a Caesar imposing a rule, but as kind of a, I think he wrote before Paul Tillich did, but I think his concept lines up fairly well with Paul Tillich's idea of the ground of being as being a definition, which has nothing to do with autocratic, fiat or anything like that. But similar to the way we talked about how the occasion was dipolar, had a mental pole and a physical pole. In Whitehead's conception, the divine, God, is also dipolar. And so he talks about the primordial nature of God. And it is the primordial nature that is the source and order of all that is logically possible. So if these eternal objects are pure potentialities, then quite simply, the primordial nature of God to Whitehead is the source of the potential. Where does the possibility of what might be realized in the future comes from? To Whitehead, that's in the primordial nature of God. And the primordial nature doesn't change. And so, in one way, it kind of fits with Aristotle's idea of God, from the standpoint of the unmoved mover. But that's only part of the story, because to a theistic person, Whitehead makes the very shocking statement that the primordial nature of God is deficient in actuality. So, you remember we call those occasions actual occasions? To Whitehead, actuality is what actually becomes concrete in the world. In his ontology, the possibilities are equally ontologically real, but they are not actual. Actuality involves the collapse of these possibilities into one choice that fits into the other choices of the matrix in which it happens. And so the holder, if you will, of these unrealized possibilities, is for him the primordial nature of God, and that is kind of the fixed point. But because this primordial nature is deficient in actuality, that's really the source of this process itself, because the primordial nature is seeking actuality. it doesn't want to be, I'm using anthropomorphic language here, but it doesn't want to be in this undifferentiated realm of pure possibility. It wants action. It wants process. It wants results. And so you kick off this process. When I think about that, I'm reminded of, this is not from Whitehead, but this is kind of where I relate to this idea. I'm reminded of the children's story of the Velveteen Rabbit that wanted to be real.
you know, when you talk about the primordial nature of fiction and actuality, you know, that there's a desire to be tangible, to be embodied, you know, to be. And so for Whitehead, that's the other nature of this dipolar side, which is the consequential nature. You could refer to the consequential nature as the world process, but this is that which receives and preserves and values the order of the self-realized relations of the actual occasions. One thing I kind of left out of my summary, but I think was sort of implicit, is that these occasions are by definition relational. You know, they don't exist, unlike the substance of Aristotle, they don't exist in isolation. You know, occasions are only defined by their nexus. He uses the word nexus and connection with other occasions. And so what holds that together for him is the consequential nature. And when I think of this idea, I think about a big hard drive on a computer that saves everything, or the idea of a blockchain in which, you know, nothing is ever lost, you know, every single move, you know, is memorialized. And I think that's Whitehead's notion, is that in this consequential nature, every occasion is preserved. And he refers to that actually as the doctrine of objective immortality. You know, in the timeless sense, consequential nature, no occasion is ever lost. You know, it seems to us that we see the fleeting present. You know, we see it passing, we see it fading away, we see it lost. But that's only from the perspective, you know, of the occasion, which is completing itself. You know, he says the occasion, you know, sort of comes into being, you know, it instantaneously sort of dies and fades away, but it fades away and yet it endures forever, you know, because what it contributes to the next occasion and really to the world at large is never lost. And if you just look at the succession of an individual personality, that's handed down. You know, what the experience I had a moment ago is handed down to who I am now. So if you just look at that experience, it's gone, it's dead, you know, it's gone. No, it's not. It's preserved. You know, I'm here. I'm carrying forward that flame, that tradition, and so that to him is the consequential nature. So this could be. I've given another talk at this forum about panentheism, and so this combination of the primordial nature and the consequential nature is an example of a panentheistic concept of the divine, which is, I think, can be contrasted with both a theistic and an atheistic. I think a lot of people think that the only two alternatives are atheism and theism, but I think Whitehead gives you some other alternatives to that. So that's kind of a, you know, in that time, I don't really do justice to the rigor of the method of Whitehead, but that's kind of the tedious part. But he does have these kind of poetic passages like the one I read, but those are kind of few and far between. A lot of it's very much plotting, you know, through the method of deriving these things, and he still kind of has his mathematical, you know, sort of proof hat on in the way he goes through these. So why aren't the ideas of Alfred North Whitehead more widely accepted? I think there's kind of three main objections to Whitehead. First of all, you know, too much of it is really contrary to common sense. You know, it does require you to sort of step out of the practical everyday and sort of, you know, be willing to take this excursion to most fundamental principles so that you can let those fundamental principles sort of guide you, you know, in developing it out from there. And so, interestingly, though, he was a fan of the pragmatic philosophers like Dewey and James, but you could say in a way it's maybe not so pragmatic. You know, it's a little theoretical. Secondly, quite frankly, is that some people have an allergic reaction to the role he brings to the concept he calls God into the system. And thirdly, it's very hard to comprehend. Reading reading Whitehead is a true struggle of love, you know, a work, what's the right word?
Labor of love.
Labor of love is what I'm looking for me. But it's not very easy going. So speaking of the actual occasion being objectively immortal and contributing to the next moment, so what are the influences of Alfred North Whitehead in the world? Well, not so much his immediate students, Bertrand Russell and Willard Quine, you know, neither of whom really went with him all the way through the development of his theory, but he does have followers in other places, most notably the Chicago School of Theology widely adopted Whitehead's system as a basis for their system in, I guess this would have been, you know, 30s and 40s mostly, maybe 50s a little bit. And I had the privilege as an undergraduate at the University of Texas of taking a class in philosophical theology from Charles Hartshorne, who was an emeritus professor and had his training at the University of Chicago and was exposed to this tradition. So that's where I first became acquainted with this way of thinking. There's another professor, Wieman, I guess that's fairly or somewhat well-known from Chicago. And then in more modern times than that, at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California, he's now in favor. And his main well-known proponent today is a guy named David Ray Griffin, who actually edited this particular, not really translation, but they actually, they cleaned up his manuscript because apparently editing was not his thing, you know, and he had commas missing and words and all that, so there's detailed notes in the back about where they filled in words that he had left out and all that kind of thing. And then, interestingly, I didn't know this until getting ready for this talk, but he is beginning to catch on in China, and there are 23 university-created centers in China for the study of Whitehead's philosophy. What I read is that the Chinese find it sort of a useful way to add in some of their Confucian virtues to kind of a Western science-based, prototype. And then a lot of articles you read don't mention this, but some of this Lorem study integral theory, Whitehead's process philosophy is one of the main influences of integral theory, although there are several other influences in integral theory. And integral theory is a lot easier to understand than Whitehead is, so, you know, might be a gateway drug to Whitehead would be to study integral theory. And then lastly, there are certain French continental philosophers currently active, such as Gilles Deleuze and Bruno Latour, and some people say Merleau-Ponty, who are influenced by Whitehead's ideas. And so this is an interesting transcription of the Anglo-English tradition into continental thinkers, and some of the continental thinkers are now, there's a Belgian philosopher, a French-speaking Belgian philosopher named Isabelle Stenger, who has a book called Thinking with Whitehead, who is a Whitehead fan and a Deleuze fan. So you know, maybe not as well-known as some other philosophers, but whether you accept the worldview or not, I would submit that Whitehead presents some alternatives to some of these choices in thinking about things like free will determinism, mind-body, some of these other things that are, for that matter, atheism, theism, that are not often recognized as possible positions. And so even if you want to nothing more than just to catalog the possible philosophical traditions, I think a familiarity with Whitehead will add to the repertoire of understanding those. So that's pretty much my prepared remarks. I'll be glad to entertain questions. Yes, yeah.
I wish I could remember how I know this, but I've got it at the back of my head somewhere that Richard Feynman credited Whitehead with the idea that he termed solar histories, which is, if you've read any of that, it's the Feynman diagram and so forth. So there's another influence, I think. What I really want to ask you about, though, was a little bit earlier. While Whitehead, I think, was developing these ideas, and I'm not sure exactly the timeline, there were a couple of dozen physicists that met periodically in Copenhagen that were talking about essentially the same stuff, that concrescence is the collapse of the wave function in physical terms. It's hard to believe that there wasn't some cross-pollinization going on there. And I wonder if you've come on any of that.
I would not be surprised at all. You're talking about Niels Bohr and people like that. You know, I haven't come across any mention of correspondence between the two.
I don't remember any either.
But I would sure think that they would have found each other and conversed. And I think your sum of possibilities, I don't know that for a fact either, but I could definitely see that because, you know, Whitehead does talk about the sort of the matrix of what he calls adjacent possibles, you know, for the outcome of each moment, and, you know, and it would arrange sort of like a probability, you know, some of them are kind of least resistance and some of them, you know, maybe are a little less probable, you know, just on a probability phrase. And, you know, he talks about these eternal objects, I didn't get this phrase out, but as a lure for feeling. You know, so, you know, that word lure is kind of interesting because, you know, it's sort of, I sort of picture, you know, this idea of the white-headed god, you know, sort of with a fishing rod, you know, and he's throwing out the fly or something like that to, you know, see if I'll take it, you know, and that, and, but yeah, he likes that lure metaphor. Brian?
Yes, good. I put the allergic to the idea that love comes from God. Having studied, there's an alternative point of view, one of many alternatives, and you said obviously there are many alternatives, but I thought that love was a response, animal response, that neurophysiologists and evolutionary psychologists think started when mammals first were selected for their ability to care for the young, and then it broadened into caring for kittens and these innate unconscious motivations were selected for, you know, in the 10,000 generations or so that people have been living not only with kin but with other people in the tribe and so on. So we don't have to think of something coming in from the cosmos to cause us to love one another. It could be the structure of the brain and the hormonal system, the neurotransmitters encoded in the DNA. In that case, I guess you could think of evolution as and the DNA as a name for God. So do you think they're reconcilable?
I think in the way I would look at it, that view is a lesser included. You know, I mean, that's a somewhat reductionist view that is probably valid insofar as you want to look at the biological, you know, mammalian, you know, history, genealogy, you know, of, but if you go the other extreme on metaphysics, I mean, you could even conceive of love as a way of talking about the attraction of a positive and negative pole. I mean, you know, it depends on how you define it. I mean, some people would define gravity as love, you know, from a wide metaphysical standpoint. Anything that brings separate things together, you know, from a broad standpoint, you know, Ken Wilber makes the comment that when the lion is, you know, chasing the gazelle and about to eat the gazelle, it loves the gazelle. It's not doing it out of hate. You know, it's not doing it out, you know, because it wants, you know, it doesn't like, you know, it loves the gazelle, loves so much it wants to eat it up. You know, so you know, of course, then you get the difference between Eros and Agape and you know, the different meanings. So I think what you've offered is certainly valid within a frame of reference. And it's like anything else, it's how broad you want. When you go to metaphysics as a subject matter, I think most people would say part of that is kind of broadening the language from a, you know, let's look at mammalian evolution or something like that.
It's
it involves human feelings. I mean, it's not mechanical. It's an understanding of where our feelings come from, which I think is what Whitehead was trying to do. So it's an alternative.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Question here. Yeah, David.
David, I guess I don't know if it's right, but my idea with a process philosophy or process is that there's a becoming or an evolving or a growing. And this kind of goes along with the growing and evolving universe, that this new concept that came out, you know, at about this time. And also with Paul Tillich's idea that if you're, you know, pantheistic or panentheistic, God is growing with the universe. He's in this process. Is this part of the Whitehead's thing?
Yeah, it is. I didn't draw that part out so much because there's only so much you can cover in the time. But in this process by which the occasion, you know, prehends these eternal ideas and selects from the possibility, then, you know, there's this lure for feeling, and Whitehead uses the term created advance to novelty. And so if the occasion, you know, maximizes that lure for feeling, then it does, you know, another Whiteheadian term I didn't run here is ingression. You know, the eternal objects ingress into the occasion. And so, you know, if you think of love, truth, beauty, joy, you know, as species of these eternal objects, then they will ingress into the occasion to the extent that, you know, they are prehended by the occasion. And in his theory, the more that those are ingressed into the occasion, then you will have this creative advance in the novelty. Creativity is almost a bigger word than God, and some would argue that it is in the Whiteheadian system, because creativity transcends this dipolar situation between the primordial and the consequential, and that's the outcome of the primordial feeling itself deficient in actuality and wanting to, or needing the consequential. You know, he says things like, God needs the world as much as the world needs God. You know, and so it's and that is the creativity and the evolution and the advance, is that, you know, the product of that mutual need, if you will. So thank you for bringing that up.
How does free will fit into the Whitehead framework?
Free will would involve the occasion's response to the lure of those eternal objects, and so Whitehead sometimes uses this kind of language, like there's an initial aim, which would be the best outcome, you know, for that occasion. And the occasion is able to select, you know, to what extent that will be part of the concrescence of that moment. And so the free will consists of, you know, either accepting the fullness of that initial aim or, you know, basically rejecting it. And so it's not unconstrained free will. It's not the kind of free will that existentialists talk about, you know, where you can, it's free will within a constraint of coherent possibilities presented by the input from the others. But from the exercise of that free will moment to moment, there is the idea that the creative process will advance.
But if every actualized object, it has its own concrescence, and they're all together, coordinated, they're all exercising free will and choice at the same time. I don't understand how anything ever has a concrescence in that they're all making choices ad infinitum.
Yeah, because they're all inhabiting the same, they all have the same causal past. And so the choices of each of them are constrained by the causal past, and then the effect of them on the causal future is going to be constrained
to a certain extent by the choices of the other.
Correct, sometimes that you wouldn't call it free will. You would call it path dependence, concrescence.
It depends on how you define it. I mean, some people will define free will as kind of like an absolute free will, you know, like I'm completely unconstrained. That would definitely not be the Whiteheadian notion. But his notion is also not the deterministic notion that from a given input, there's only one possible future, you know, as the outcome. You know, inside this occasion, there is that range of possible futures, which in the case of an electron or something like that, it might just be what we call random choice. You know, there's not really any kind of meaningful selection, but there are two possible futures. In the case of more developed entities, then it would be more of a conscious choice of, you know, do I take path A or do I take path B? But and so he would definitely hope that you have free will within those constraints, you know, as to those particular choices. But yeah, you're constrained by your contemporaneous occasions as far as your influence on the future, and you're constrained by your past.
Question here, David.
David, so I'm asking you a question now, but I've had thousands of influences that have probably led me to want to ask you this question. And all these thousands of people that have influenced me have thousands of influences themselves. So is your nexus really all part of one network? Are we all part of the same interconnected nexus?
Yes. Yeah, I did not emphasize the concept of nexus so much, but that's a word that he uses a whole lot. And the answer is yes. The occasions are only defined by their nexus, and you can't help but have a nexus to every occasion in your causal past. You know, you can make it unconscious. He even has the idea of a negative prehension, which is not that it doesn't affect you, but that you basically deny that it affects you. You know, that's what he calls a negative prehension. But you. In his system, you prehend all occasions in your causal past, you know, whether you want to or not. But nevertheless, there is a range of possible future, you know, that sufficiently developed organisms can consciously select, you know, from that menu of possibilities.
Question here. Robert?
Okay. You know, some of this you may have already kind of answered. But I'm taking notes, and as I take notes, I miss some of what you say, so bear with me here. First, let me mention that when you talked about Chinese institutes studying Whitehead, there's a book called Boston Confucianism, and that is a group of professors up in Boston who study Confucianism, and they were really big on Whitehead and process theology. Okay. But here's two things, okay? First of all, you talk about events and occasions are like, seems like you said that they're kind of like actions. And then, but, you know, you have a mental pull and a physical pull, and then those are parts of an occasion. One of the things that I use to try and connect that to what I know in computer science is how we went beyond formulating problems in terms of data, which would be like substance, into a combination of data and actions upon the data, which we call classes. And that really sounds like kind of like this dipole nature that you're describing. And then also, when you talked about consequential nature and occasions constantly influencing so much, didn't Hawking say something about the importance of maintaining information, and that they found that the black hole at one time, the story, it would destroy information, then it found out it squirted stuff out, and somehow or another it was supposed to maintain a conservation of information. But I guess I'd like
your question.
Yeah. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit more about the dipole nature and also the unconsequential nature? Because somehow or another they're just like murky in my mind.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. First of all, I guess before I get to that on the computer thing, I think that's a good insight. I think he does use the term datum, you know, for this input,
And so I think, and I'm not a computer scientist myself, but I would think that the distinction between the datum and the action would kind of correspond to his distinction between the datum and the occasion, you know, because the occasion is how you prehend that action, you know, and basically what you output, you know, from, I mean, excuse me, what you output from that data, you know, is so I think that's valid. As far as Hawking goes, I know he does talk about preserving information, you know, even in a black hole and all that, so I think that might be getting a little bit, you know, to sort of the physicist corollary of this consequential nature, you know, although he's in a very different domain. And then the question you finally led up to was, I've already lost that one, I'm sorry.
Yeah, could you, I wasn't certain that I understood what you meant by the consequential nature.
The dipolar. The dipolar.
Yeah, and,
okay.
And then also the bipolar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If I said bipolar, that was, he uses the word dipolar, although I suppose those are really mean the same thing. But bipolar, I guess, has kind of the diagnostic, you know, suggestion to it. But let me see if I can find a way to approach that. Because the dipolar is both a characteristic of the divine nature in his theory and of the individual occasion. And from the standpoint of the individual occasion, it has to do with what the object of the prehension is. And so if you are prehending other actual occasions, mm-hmm. then that is the physical pole. If you are prehending eternal objects, mm-hmm. then that is the mental pole. And there's another one I left out. I knew I couldn't get everything in an hour. He's also got a theory of propositions, which are in between physical occasions and eternal objects. And so a proposition is sort of, as the name might entail, just a, you know, a statement, you know, logical statement about, you know, if Socrates is more, you know, Socrates is a man, and, you know, if he's a man, he's mortal, and those kind of things. And so you can, that's kind of his logical theory, if you will, which is part of his philosophy. And so you can, your mental pole will prehend both these propositions and the eternal objects. Your physical pole will prehend actual occasions. And so I sort of think of them like they're two antennas, you know, tuned to different, you know, to different frequencies is the way I think about it. And so if you translate that to, you know, the divine, then the physical pole is the consequential. That's what's embodied. You know, that's the collection of actual occasions, you know, that are sort of, you know, logged in the register, if you will. You know, this actual occasion, you know, concressed, you know, this actual occasion concressed, they're all recorded here. That's the physical pole. The mental pole is, gee, what is possible? You know, what could happen? Whereas the physical is what actually does happen.
I had a question, David, on these prehensions or these inputs. Did he differentiate at all? Do you like to differentiate at all regarding the environmental prehensions and the genetic prehensions?
A little bit. I don't know if I can do that part justice or not, but he did talk about you know, prehensions of organs in the body, you know, as opposed to prehensions of external occasions. And, you know, and actually, from the standpoint of propositions I talked about, those would include not only logical propositions, but, you know, say survival propositions that have been encoded into the DNA. And so if the DNA, you know, teaches the, you know, baby seal to, you know, slide off the ice and start swimming immediately or something, then that is a proposition about, you know, corresponding to the world that is judged by its survival value. And
DNA.
Yeah, proposition is any statement about, you know, hypothetically, what would happen if you took a certain action? How would that action be incorporated into the future, you know, worldview? And so from a survival value, they're programmed in, you know, by DNA. From a noetic standpoint, you get to entertain them as hypotheticals, you know, and you can say, let me think through what would happen
you know, if I made this choice, and let me think through what I'd have to make this choice, you know, whereas the biological evolution of propositions is more trial and error, you know, this works and so it survives, and this doesn't work, so it doesn't survive.
Very good, thank you. We have time for one last question. Anybody have a last question? Yes?
In talking about free will, you mentioned selection from a menu of possibilities. What is the metaphysical property of selection? What is the selection process? What is that then?
It is the subject of the occasion. Subject is to my head, the prehension is not totally passive. Always, it can be passive. You know, like if a rock falls off the ceiling and hits me in the head, that's a passive prehension. You know, I can't do anything about it. But other prehensions, there may be a little bit of interpretation in how you perceive it. And then in terms of your output, your action, if you will, you can make certain selections. And so there's a little bit of sort of an interpretation of the experience element, but then there's also an element of when I see these possibilities, you know, I mean, one possibility is, you know, I'm in jail, you know, I try to dig a hole underneath or something, you know, I mean, that's a possibility that I can either exercise free will to do or not. I don't know if that gets at your question or not, but I mean, it's the proposition. Can I go back to the proposition? You know, it's sort of a proposition of a possible future, and you know, do you accept that proposition or do you not accept that proposition?
But what is it making? You said you make that choice on the proposition. That means based on some probability, I have this behavior or that behavior. What is the mechanism that you're saying you make the choice? What is the choice?
He calls it subjective aim. And so it's the subject part of this superject. You know, the subjective aim is what outcome does the subject want for the occasion?
But how do you determine? Must have some feeling about good, bad,
yeah,
and whether it wants good or bad.
That's the lure for feeling. The lure for feeling, these eternal objects and the mental conception of the eternal objects.
So there is an algorithm of lure plus prehension.
Yes, it's the lure. I mean, the acceptance of the eternal object, the lure is itself a prehension. That's a prehension of eternal object instead of a prehension of an actual occasion. And so if you only accepted prehensions of actual occasions and ignored all eternal objects, then you would be completely determined by your environment and would be exercising no free will. It'd be sort of the zombie scenario, I guess. You know, but if you are entertaining this lure, you know, of a possibility of, oh, that could be beautiful, that could be good, you know, that could help my friend, you know, that could get me out of jail, then that's where you're prehending not only the actual occasion, but the possibility. It comes down simply, I made it too complicated. It's whether you're prehending only actualities or whether you're prehending actualities and possibilities. If you're prehending possibilities, then you have free will. Okay. If you're any actualities, you don't.
Let's get another round of applause. And in 2 weeks, we have Bradley Carter, my old professor, young professor, from SMU on political science. He'll be speaking about the changing political landscape. He's currently a professor emeritus at SMU and a dynamic speaker, so I'll see everybody in 2 weeks. Thanks again.